Welcome to Evolve, Reinventing Leadership, Building Freedom Cultures, with CEO and award-winning author, Yvette Bethel. This podcast is dedicated to providing leaders with solutions to build trust, inspire authentic transformation, and improve engagement. Learn about new and tested ways you can revitalize your culture, empower people, and transform your results.
This is Yvette Bethel, and I am excited to welcome you to Evolve, Reinventing Leadership, Building Freedom Cultures. Evolve challenges traditional leadership paradigms and explores modern leadership models, providing ideas you can use to transform your culture. We focus on leadership through the lens of interconnectivity, flow, and balance, exploring ideas that translate into practical applications for contemporary organizational challenges. Our topic for this episode of Evolve is leading from the jump seat. And to explore this with us, consultant, executive coach, speaker, author, and pilot, Peter Docker. Peter worked with Simon Sinek for over 7 years and was one of the founding igniters on Simon's team. He took his years of practical experience to co-author Find Your Why with Simon and David Mead. His latest book, Leading from the Jump Seat, How to Create Extraordinary Opportunities by Handing Over Control, was just published in October 2021. Peter's commercial and industry experience has been at the most senior levels. His clients include Google, Four Seasons Hotel, Accenture, American Express, NBC Universal, and over 100 more. Peter served for 25 years as an Air Royal Air Force senior officer. He has been a force commander during combat flying operations and has been in service across the globe. His career spanned from professional pilot to an aviation training and standards organization to flying the British Prime Minister around the world. Hello, Peter.
Hi, Yvette. What a wonderful introduction. I love it.
You gave it to me. So good to have you join us, Peter.
Oh, it's a delight to be here. Thank you, Yvette, for having me on your show.
Oh, so after hearing about your amazing background, I'm just curious about what led you to this point, you know, talking about the jump seat and leadership from it. What led you here? What led you here?
Good heavens. Well, over the past couple of years, I've had the opportunity, like perhaps many of us, with what's going on in the world, just to sit back and reflect a little bit. And well, all those things you mentioned, Yvette, in your wonderful introduction, it represents how fortunate I've been in my life. I've had so many different experiences. You know, I've traveled to 93 countries, worked with people in every industry you can imagine. And, you know, that's been a great joy. And along the way, I've discovered that what brings us together is so much more as the human race than what keeps us apart, what separates us. And that gives me great hope for the future. So how I got here was that I wanted to bring together all the things that I've learned from the experiences that I've had, the people I've met, the great leadership I've seen, the not so good leadership too, and put it into a book so others can benefit from it. And, you know, my book, the latest one, Leading from the Jump Seat, is a how-to book. It's all about how to create extraordinary opportunities by handing over control, which is kind of counterintuitive as a leader, I guess. But it's the main theme of the book and brings together everything really that I've learned.
Well, why leadership? What you know inspires you about it? What got you on this path to talk about it?
Well, when I look back at all the things that I've done in my life, the time when, well, literally actually brings a tear to my eye is when I see people being extraordinary. Mm-hmm. And extraordinary, one person's extraordinary is not another's, you know? When I say about people being extraordinary, I mean being extraordinary in their terms, in their context. and climbing their own mountains and accomplishing way more than they thought they might be able to, and bringing who they truly are to the world, you know. One level, you know, just watching, say, the Olympics. I love sport. I participate, but I'm not a sport nerd, should we say, you know, but I like watching big events like the Olympics. But I'm hopeless of it. You know, when I see people crossing the finish line or achieving a personal best or whatever it is, I get choked up. You know, I can't speak. So, you know, at the root of everything that I do that really brings me joy is creating the opportunity to lift others up so they can reach their potential and really thrive. And that for me goes to the root of leadership. You know, jump seat leadership, it's not about retaining or growing your own power. It's about empowering others. It's about creating that space where others can step into that space and we can lift them up, you know, and they can fly. So that's what leadership means to me. And some of my greatest recollections of my life are seeing people that I've worked with over the years really excel and thrive. That's what puts a smile on my face. So that's leadership.
Yeah, wow. It seems so authentic. So many people say that. And, you know, when people start to excel, they start to feel threatened. So it's powerful that, you know, you actually seem to feel that.
Oh, totally.
The jump seat. I've been a passenger on an airplane. Yeah. People have, and we all hear about this jump seat. And, you know, we don't know much about it other than, you know, crew members can sit there. But help us establish, like, what is this jump seat and why is it central to your theme for your book?
Sure. So the idea of the phrase leading from the jump seat, the catalyst for that actually occurred way back in about 2002 when I was a senior pilot. I was in charge of a lot of people, and part of my job was to certify new pilots. And on this particular occasion, I was certifying a new captain. He'd been a first officer, a co-pilot for many years, and he went through the transition to become a captain. And you do about 6 months of training, and then the final part of that certification is where the candidate would fly with someone like me from A to B to C to D, and I give them the final check. And so it was with this fellow called Callum, great young pilot. And we flew from London to Washington Dulles, then on to San Francisco, which is a very busy airport. And Callum did a fantastic job. We taxied in, he shut down. And it was with great joy I could turn to him and say, Callum, fantastic job. I'm signing you up now. You're a fully certified captain to fly this passenger jet with 140 people anywhere in the world. That's what it meant to certify him. We're going to stop here the night, but then in the morning, I'm going to be down the back with the rest of the passengers. You'll have a regular crew up front and you can fly us back to Washington and then on to London. So that was the plan. In the morning, Callum came to me and he said, excuse me, sir. And he called me sir because we're in the military and I was his senior boss. He said, it's very busy here in San Francisco during rush hour. He said, can you come and sit on the jump seat just to act as an extra pair of eyes as we taxi out and make sure we are the right way, et cetera. And I said, yes, of course, Captain, I'll be delighted. And at the time, I thought that's a very courageous move from Callum because he just got me off his back after months of training and checking, you know, but to invite me back onto the flight deck in service of the safety of the aeroplane, you know, that took courage. And where he wanted me to sit was on this jump seat, which, as you rightly point out, is on the flight deck on many large passenger jets. And it's immediately behind the two pilots. You've got the captain, the co-pilot, and then the jump seat is immediately behind. If you sat there, you can reach the pilots, you know, you're that close. And it's usually empty, but a crew member can hitch a lift. And that's where I sat as we taxied out. And Callum didn't have any problem at all. You know, he was hugely competent. We lined up on the runway. It was our turn to take off. And we thundered down that runway and we got airborne. But then around about 300 or 400 feet, very close to the ground, we effectively had an emergency. And that emergency, we hit severe turbulence. Now, anyone who's flown has probably experienced turbulence, and up at 35,000 feet, you know, it's uncomfortable. A few drinks get spilled, but it's okay, you know. But down so close to the ground, 300 or 400 feet above the ground, this was a real threat. And Callum was wrestling with the controls to stop us hitting the ground, you know. And in that moment, what I decided to do in the next 2 seconds would fundamentally affect whether we all survive that or not, you know. And perhaps some people, you know, in my position as the most experienced pilot on the aircraft, you might have been tempted to reach forward and take over control, you know, or shout encouragement or whatever. Actually, I did none of that. I sat there quite calmly with my hands in my lap and just allowed Callum to get on with it. Because what he needed at that moment was not for me to be a leader. He needed me to be a great follower. He needed to feel that I had his back to give him the humble confidence to do what he needed to do. And of course, he sorted out the emergency, no problem at all. But that was the catalyst from leading from the jump seat, because, you know, the flight deck of an aircraft is a great metaphor for leadership. I've seen some great leadership and very poor leadership on a flight deck of an aeroplane, but in life, Yvette, we all eventually hand over control. We all do. You know, if you're the CEO of the biggest company, you eventually retire, take a step back. If you're leading a team, you'll probably move on at some stage. Or heck, even as a parent, you know, your children grow up, leave home and start leading their own lives. So handing over control is inevitable. Leading from the jump seat is all about how do we lead with that intention of handing over control? Because when we have that as our guiding context, it shifts how we relate to our people, because it has us focus on lifting them up, equipping them, so then when the time is right, they can carry forward those things that are really important to us. On the flight deck of that aeroplane all those years ago, what was really important to all of us was surviving the situation. Mm-hmm. But, you know, taking it to the other extreme of the example, what's important to us as parents, perhaps, is that our children carry forward what we might call values, or those things that are really important to us as a family, onto the next generation, you know? So that's what Lean from the Jump Seat is all about. It's about handing over control. And when we do that, remarkable things actually happen too, which I can talk about. But I've been talking for a long time, Yvette, so I'm going to pause there and let you ask another question.
You know, you should have said spoiler alert, because I know that's the first story. The cliffhanger.
Oh, yeah.
In your book.
True. But yeah, you know, I think I need to share it, because otherwise your listeners will be thinking, what the heck is this jump?
What you're talking about in handing over control, control is, I think, one of the bases of power. And it's not always so easy, because it entangles ego and a whole lot of insecurity and things. And in your experience, how easy is it to actually do what you're talking about? Because you say it with such ease and grace, but a lot of people even intertwine their identities with the power and the role or whatever. So how do you do that?
Well, it's not easy. however, there are things which can help us. So like everything to do with leadership, it really starts with the person in the mirror, you know? And what I believe really helps us is getting clear, first of all, on what's really important to us as an individual, you know? I think, for example, most of us can probably agree that family is important. A couple of years ago, my wife gave me a phone call, and she'd just been involved in a car accident. And I was on a business call, a bit like this, and immediately I dropped everything and went to help. And everybody understood that, because it's a near universal value, you know, or something that's really important to most of us, family. But here's the thing, it unlocked the enormous amount of energy inside of me. There was nothing that would have stopped me from going to help my wife, who thankfully was fine, but I didn't know that when I left the house. But I stepped into the unknown with the energy to take on any challenge that may have faced me. And it made me think, you know, if we can put into words the other things that light that fire inside of us, which are really so deeply ingrained in us, the non-negotiables, that energy provides a reserve that we can draw on when we're figuring out to lead or we're finding ourselves in tough circumstances. And you know, I share some of this in the book about how some of my fundamental drivers, if you like, are the notion of not being dependent on anybody or being a burden on someone. That goes back to my childhood. Also, the notion of mutual respect is hugely important to me. You know, if I see people not being respected, regardless of race, culture, beliefs, whatever, then that really grates with me and causes me to step into that unknown and take on the challenge. And when we can identify those things, it gives us a foundation, a handrail, if you like, mixing those metaphors, where when we're in that situation of leadership where we think I need to hand over control, mm-hmm. it gives us the courage to do that. Because when we're operating in the unknown, we don't have a map. We haven't got a guidebook to tell us what to do. But what we do have are those deeply rooted beliefs, which I call stands, things that were really important to us, things that we stand for in life, not positions against. You know, that releases a whole different energy. Mm-hmm. But when we're a stand for things, it gives us the courage to step forward when otherwise we might hesitate. And that includes the courage to step forward, to hand over control to others who can help us figure out the challenges, the solutions to the challenges that we're facing.
You know, it's the stands that you talk about, they sound like core values, and taking a deeper look at who we are and what we value so we can take a stand for something. And I can see that being central to shifting power is really looking at what you value, because power tends to show up extrinsically and people run after it. But there's another type of power that's intrinsic. And it sounds like you're saying, go within and tap into that intrinsic power so that you can make that shift.
Yeah, and I agree with one small caveat, which is when we're talking about values, because as I sat down to write this book, I thought, you know what? Values aren't as fixed as we might like to think they are.
Yeah.
And this is why I went deeper into drivers. So I'll come back to that. But to give you an example, many of us like to think that we're courteous and we think of others. Yeah. But how about if you're driving to a business meeting and you're late and you get to the car park, the parking lot, and there's one space left and you can see out the corner of your eyes someone else looking for that car parking space, and you kind of ignore them and you park your car up and in you go. Now, you might feel a bit bad about it, but what's happened to your value of being courteous? Values tend to flex with the circumstances. Drivers, though, go much, much deeper. Those are the non-negotiables. So I think there's a relationship between them. But in my experience in business and in life, I've seen people's values shift too often for them to be a constant. That's why I like to talk about drivers. And those are linked to the things which are so deeply ingrained in us, so important to us, that they are non-negotiable.
Interesting. So I think a lot of organizations are based on the command and control model. And leading from the jump seat is now suggesting, that's not really it. You get so much more out of not doing that.
Absolutely.
We started talking about it already, but what steps, without divulging too much, I guess, but what steps do you take a company through to help them to transition to releasing that control?
Well, the starting point actually is recognizing that there are only two things in this world that drive us forward when something is really important to us. Only two. And those two things are fear and also love. Mm-hmm. Now, I'll come back to the love word, because in business, people get a bit twitchy around that, but I'll explain.
It's fine with me on my podcast.
Yeah, well, I think in similar ways, Yvette, but, you know, go into a some particularly Western culture businesses, or maybe other cultures too, people don't talk about love in the workplace. But let's deal with fear, first of all, you know. Mm-hmm. Fear gets triggered when we sense our life is in danger, and that's fine. You know, when we step into a road and a car's coming, we step back out of fear, and that saves our life. So that's useful. But fear is less useful when it's triggered by three other things. And those three things are when we sense our livelihood, our status, or our reputation is under threat. And those things come under threat in business quite often. And that's when it triggers fear. And the way fear shows up then, well, it can show up in a number of ways. It can show up in terms of anger or even timidity at the other end of the scale. But universally, what tends to happen is that we close down, we start thinking just about ourselves rather than others. And thinking about ourselves is epitomized by the driver of ego. Ego raises its head, and ego is Greek for I. You know, it's all about me. Mm-hmm. And when that happens, it closes down possibility and alienates people, and you stop working as a team. The good news is we always have a choice. And that choice is, when we see fear being, or sense fear being triggered inside of us, see it as a warning flag. And use that warning flag to choose to be led instead, or driven by love. And the way love shows up in teams or in business is when we're thinking about others, when we're in service of others, not just ourselves. When we see the world's a place of opportunity and possibility rather than a place of scarcity. And most importantly, the antidote to ego, which is what I call humble confidence. And humble confidence is, what I mean by that is, when we have humble confidence, we're absolutely resolute in where we're heading. And we're willing to take decisions, even the tough ones, when they need to be taken. But most importantly, we're willing to listen to others. And we don't naturally assume that it's us who has the answer, or indeed us that it's expected to have the answer. And this comes to your command and control piece. You know, if people lead by command and control, people expect that leader to have the answer to all the problems you're facing. Mm-hmm. But if you don't have the answer, you become the constriction in the pipe.
That's right.
In other words, your team can only advance as quickly as you are able to come up with the answers. Mm-hmm. But when you bring forward humble confidence instead of ego, when you source yourself from a place of love rather than fear, it gives you the courage to listen and open up the floor, if you will, to others on your team to contribute to the solution to the challenges you're facing. And that's when you start to access what I call the collective genius of your people. Mm-hmm. And that's when you are no longer the constriction of the pipe, and you accelerate the progress of your team. So in answer to your question, how do I start to bring this to companies? It's helping them to realize, first of all, that everything is driven, that's important to us, everything is driven by either love or fear, and that we have a choice. And the thing that links love and fear is courage. Courage can't exist without fear, but it can only be sustained by the love for something. And when we can tap into that, when we can link that love for something to what's really important to us as human beings, as individuals, as we were talking about a moment ago, then that gives us the courage to find the humble confidence where we then hand over control to others who can help us figure out the solutions.
One of the things that I write about and explore is systems and structures. And a command and control model has an interpersonal kind of component. There's also the systemic consideration. From your experience, how do you start to transform the system and the structures, you know, the policies, the procedures, the org charts, all those different things that have command and control embedded within it that would contradict the interpersonal work that you do? How do you address that?
Well, to have systems that do not contradict, as you put it, the interpersonal work. You know, the systems and processes, if you take away human beings and culture and leadership and you stack all the systems and processes up in a corner, you got nothing, you know? So systems and processes should support the culture that you want, the way around, not the other way around. So, for example, one of the other practices of leading from the jump seat, being a jump seat leader, is around nurturing a sense of belonging. And that's hugely important. And I see it as a, well, the duty of anyone in a leadership position, a formal leadership role, to nurture that sense of belonging. Why? Well, when we feel that we belong, then we choose to step up and contribute. In other words, we choose to lead, mm-hmm. choose to get involved. When people feel they don't belong, then they tend to withdraw. So let me give you a real example. You mentioned in your kind introduction that I've led people in combat. And this is true. During the 2003 Iraq war, I had 200 people in my command over in the Saudi desert. And we flew large unarmed aircraft, undefended. They were air refueling aircraft. What we did was give fuel or gas to fighter jets in the air. And to do that, we flew around in circles, and quite often we got shot at, you know, which was a bit discomforting, but there we go. It's all part of the job. And, you know, on the first night of that war, I can remember the feeling I had of seeing 40 young men and women get airborne in aircraft. I was pretty sure I wasn't going to see them all back, because the likelihood was they would be shot down. And thankfully, they did all come back. But that has weighed heavily on me for years, you know, the weight of that responsibility. And the reason it's weighed heavily on me is because in order to nurture a sense of belonging, you truly need to care about your people. This goes beyond empathy. Empathy is good, but truly caring is where you want to be at. And what that looked like out in the Gulf in 2003 for me was I was genuinely curious about my people. Regardless of how busy I was, I'd find time to sit down and talk to the most junior people on my team to check in, you know, how's your family doing? Do you have everything you need in order to do your job? And I was doing it not because I felt, oh, well, that's the sort of thing that's expected. I did it because I was genuinely curious and wanted to help. Now, coming back to your systems and processes, here's one that kicked in that reinforced the sense of belonging that we nurture in the military. During that time, several months out in the Gulf, I had no less than three of my people who received the news that one of their grandparents was, you know, close to passing away. We moved heaven and earth to get that person back to the UK so as they could be with their family. Regardless of the implications, we moved heaven and earth. We'd fly a jet out specifically to fly them back home because there wasn't any commercial air traffic aircraft. We would do everything to get them back in time. It was second nature to us. It's just one of those things that we did. Now, the systems and processes were there in order to support that. You know, we had I forget the formal name of it now, but we had a department back in the UK specifically set up to help people in these sorts of circumstances, and they would figure out the quickest way to get them home, make sure they had their appropriate priority met at the airport, driven to where they needed to be, et cetera, et cetera. So this is an example of where your systems and processes support the culture that you want to have. But it's got to start with leadership. Leadership, you know, difference for me between leadership and management. Management is about handling complexity, but leadership is about creating simplicity. And part of creating that simplicity is getting very clear on what it is you believe that's really important to you, the non-negotiables, because that then forms part of your character. And if you're part of a team that believes that too, then that creates a great environment, a great culture. Then you have your systems and processes that support that. And results come too. You know, over the 4 months that we were out in that Gulf conflict with this 40-year-old airplane that we had without enough spares, operating in sandstorms in the desert, we were tasked with 479 missions. We flew 479 missions.
Incredible.
Most importantly, everybody I took out, I brought home safe. So, you know, there's the results for you. They come with the culture that you create. And we just need to make sure that our systems and processes support that culture and not the other way around.
Oh, you know what? I'd love to talk to you in another episode about culture. That's one of my favorites. You mentioned belonging, and what I believe in is interconnectivity and caring and value. And you mentioned a lot of things that are aligned with my work. But I'd like for you to tell our audience a little bit more about belonging and connection and the importance of it in this process of releasing control.
Well, it's related to another distinction in language. Distinction in language is just, you know, putting meaning to words. And when we have distinctions that we all understand, it helps us to have conversations that we wouldn't otherwise have, and we get different results. So one of the distinctions that I use, which you won't find in the dictionary anywhere, but it's the difference between accountability and responsibility. And this links to belonging. We can make people accountable for things, but only an individual can choose to take responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So I like to keep things simple. When our children were very young, they used to play out in the street. We lived in a safe area, not many cars around, and they'd play out in the street with their friends. And if a car did come along or a stranger entered the neighborhood, we didn't know who they were, we would be accountable as parents for our own children. And so we'd go out and take care of our children, but also we felt a responsibility for the children of our neighbors. So we would take care of them too. You know, and that's a choice. You can't force anyone to make a choice.
Mm-hmm.
When people do choose to do things, it's hugely powerful. But the reason we chose to take responsibility for the children of our neighbors was because we had a strong sense of belonging to our community.
Right.
And so we chose to take responsibility. Another example I use, and you know, this is about parenting, because parenting for many of us is one of the biggest leadership challenges that we face. You know, it goes on for years, doesn't it? So it is a challenge I put to people sometimes. You know, I say, right, big leadership challenge, how do you get your teenage daughter to put her dirty laundry in the washing basket? Yeah. And you know, our children are in their late 20s and 30s now, you know, but we remember it well. And it's very difficult, but hey, just change the context a little bit. What if next weekend they're going out with their friends and they want to have their favorite outfit to wear? Is there any trouble getting them to put that laundry in the washing basket? None whatsoever. Heck, they might wash it themselves. Yeah. And the reason for that is they want to belong to their group of friends. And part of the way they choose to do that is by wearing their particular outfit that fits, or whatever it is, you know, whatever happens to be important to them. But often it's about the clothes they wear, particularly for young teenage girls. I remember my son, you know, he wasn't bothered in the slightest, but nonetheless, it was driven by the sense of belonging. Okay. So This is why it's important to nurture a sense of belonging. Because when we do, whether we're talking about our family or talking about our team, people then choose to step up and take responsibility. And that's when they start to become leaders. And we want people to become leaders because we don't want the whole organization to be dependent on us at the top of the organization or the head of the team. Because if we get ill or we move away, then what happens to the team, you know? So it's all about creating the environment where people, we are preparing our people to lead and to take over. That's hugely important. And they need to choose to take responsibility. And the way we do that is by nurturing that sense of belonging.
You know, it's interesting because you talked about fear and love earlier as being driving. I think that's a wonderful example of a form of love, belonging.
Yeah, absolutely.
That drove our behavior, you know. Yeah. There's a lot of times we don't bring the word love, as you said earlier, into the conversation about the workplace. But it's the one thing that's missing. It's necessary now to kind of heal and resolve a lot of the challenges, the interpersonal challenges that we've allowed to remain.
And we've seen that at a global scale recently over the last 18 months or so. Many people have felt their life, their livelihood, their status, and their reputation. Mm-hmm. Is that they're all under threat, and so fear starts to take hold, and we always have that choice to choose love. You know, in the book I mentioned Nelson Mandela, because when he was in prison for all of those years, it would have been so easy for him to be driven by fear, but instead he chose love. And the way love showed up was his view of possibility and opportunity in the world. You know, hope. It's another aspect of jumpseat leadership, being the guardian of hope. And hope comes from a place of love. Hope for me trumps optimism. Optimism is good, but often it's attached to a date or an event. You know, oh, it will be better by Christmas, or it'll be better by New Year's, or whatever it is. And that time comes and goes. And if it's not, then, you know, we feel devastated. But hope is an enduring belief in an after. And I was inspired, actually, some years ago. I had the opportunity to chat to a Canadian astronaut, a guy called Chris Hadfield. And I said to him, he spent 6 months on the International Space Station. I said, Chris, when you're up there, looking down at the world and all the challenges and problems that we have, what does it make you think of? And without skipping a beat, he said, hope. I said, tell me more. He said, well, you know, over the centuries, humankind has figured it out. You know, often it's not been pretty, but we figured it out eventually. And that's why I believe that anyone in a leadership role, in whatever circumstances we find ourselves in, we need to nurture not only belonging, but as part of that, we need to be the guardian of hope, a belief in the after. Because that creates a space, again, into which others can step to be inspired to help figure out what we need to do, you know? And that comes from love, not fear.
Your example about the jump seat with Callum also spoke to trust.
Yeah. Trust, well, I think trust comes from the love side of things as well, doesn't it, Yvette?
Absolutely. Yeah.
And trust, well, it's an amazing thing. You know, I was about to say that trust doesn't come instantly, but actually it can. You know, I don't need to worry you, but the next time you get on a commercial flight, the chances are that crew has only met for the first time as a crew about an hour and a half before the flight. And yet, as we saw with what was called the Miracle on the Hudson, you know, the Captain Sully, where that airliner crashed into the Hudson River just moments after takeoff, something like 30 odd seconds after takeoff. The Captain Sully and his co-pilot, I can't remember whether they'd known each other that long, but they, well, how long they'd known each other, but not very long at all. And certainly the crew down the back, you know, it was the first time collectively they were working as a crew, and yet they performed flawlessly. How do you do that?
Culture, eh?
Yeah, and you know, trust comes into it. Mm-hmm. But in those situations, trust is a product of the training that those people have had, mm-hmm. and the belief in one another, mm-hmm. and also a willingness to hand over control. Yeah. As you'll read in the book, if you haven't got there already, you know, I was 25 years old, a first officer on a passenger jet of 140 people flying into Nairobi in Kenya. And we were faced with crash landing the aeroplane. And we'd gone through trying to solve the problem. The wheels under the left wing wouldn't come down. So we were faced with having to crash land the aircraft, which is, you know, potentially very messy. It's not a good thing to do. Mm-hmm. And you can read all about it in the book. But the captain turned to me and said, I want you, Peter, to do the crash landing. Now, for lots of reasons, that was not abdicating his responsibility. It was the most powerful example of humble confidence that I've seen, that I've been a part of, where, you know, his life, his livelihood, status, and reputation are all on the line. And he could have chosen ego to be led by fear. He could have chosen, right, I'm going to do this crash landing. But actually, he was in service of others. For a whole number of reasons, I was the better person to do it. So he asked me to do the crash landing. And that, there was a large element of trust there, because the training I'd had, the role that I had at the time, the wider role. So trust came into it. And coupled with humble confidence, it's those two things are hugely energizing for any team, and the performance, the results that you get.
Oh, I could just talk about this forever. I think I'll end here with a final question. Sure. Based on your myriad experiences, what's the best advice that you can provide our listeners when it comes to leading from the jumpseat? What's one thing they should remember?
Be yourself.
Authenticity.
It was advice given to me many, many years ago when I was training as an officer in the Air Force. But at the time, I didn't fully recognize how profound that advice was. It was only later in my career when I was taking over a squadron, which is the main fighting unit of the Air Force. And it's a huge privilege to lead a squadron. It was only then that it became apparent to me how important be yourself is. And that links, Yvette, to everything we've been talking about. You know, being yourself, you need to have a foundation of understanding what's truly important to you, what really matters to you, because that gives you the courage to follow your instincts and what you believe, and be clear on the stands that you have in life.
Yeah.
And also it links to, well, what some people might call authenticity, but I prefer to talk about integrity. You know, there's a lot of conversation in business and leadership circles about being authentic, but I always had an issue with that as a notion, because, well, take the Iraq war I mentioned. If I'd been authentic, I would have shared with my people the doubts and fears that I had, but that would not have been in service of them, because they needed to be able to look to me for guidance and hope and direction, you know? So instead of authenticity, I prefer to talk about integrity. And integrity is about having a filter between what you actually feel inside and being in service of your people when you are leading a team. And so the integrity side of it was recognizing what people needed from me, and ensuring that, yes, I was myself, but I had that filter there to ensure I stayed in service of my people. So be yourself and choose to work towards integrity rather than authenticity. And Don't be too hard on yourself. We don't get it right all the time. Whatever right looks like, it's the trends and the intention that's really important. And tomorrow we can do a little bit better. And that applies still to me today as it did 30 years ago.
Yeah, with that, Peter, I'd like to thank you sincerely for joining us. Your insights will certainly help our audience to start leading from the jump seat and letting go of that control, at least, you know, a little bit, hopefully, and for some, a lot. Please tell our audience where they can find you and your latest book on the internet.
My website is curiously called leadingfromthejumpseat.com, so you can find lots of resources there. My book, by the same name, is available worldwide, the usual places. Amazon sells, I think, about 80% of books, so it's most certainly available on various Amazon sites, but also retailers around the world. And it's there in ebook, print, hardback shortly, and audiobook too. So,
wonderful.
If you like to consume, it's there.
Wonderful, wonderful. This has been Yvette Bethel and Peter Docker. And we thank you for taking the time to join us on Evolve, Reinventing Leadership, Building Freedom Cultures.
Thanks for listening to Evolve, Reinventing Leadership, Building Freedom Cultures. Join our vibrant network of leaders who are challenging the leadership paradigm in an innovative learning and impact network. Check out our webpage at ifbnetwork.co to learn more about and join our exciting ecosystem of high-performing leaders.